Thank you for joining us today for Volume 2 of our artist interview series, Articulations. This program is a collaboration between the Margaret Sloss Center for Women and Gender Equity and KHOI-FM. My name is Nancy Gebhardt, and we are thrilled to introduce you to five amazing artists in our community, from whom you'll hear every Monday at 4 p.m. during the month of October. This is the fourth interview in this volume of the series, and I'm excited to be speaking with Zoe Faye Stint. Zoe is a queer bicontinental poet with roots in both the French and American South. Their work has been nominated for the Pushcart Prize, featured or forthcoming in places such as Southern Humanities, Ninth Letter, and Poet Lore, and gathered into a chapbook, Bird Body, winner of the Cordella Press's inaugural Gwendolyn Brooks Poetry Prize. She lives right here in Ames, Iowa, where she is an MFA candidate at Iowa State University, an award-winning teacher, and a volunteer at Mustard Seed Community Farm. Welcome, Zoe.
Thank you.
So happy to have you here.
Thanks. I'm so glad to be here.
So I would love to start by talking about your book, Bird Body. Yeah. Such a huge accomplishment. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And I can't even to just be honored with that award so early in the process, and then also to be put in conversation with Gwendolyn Brooks as a poet. That's got to be a huge feeling.
God. Yeah. Kind of, I don't know what to do with that.
Sure.
It's such a huge honor, yeah.
All right, tell us more about Bird Body.
Yeah, so Bird Body is a chapbook, which means it's a short collection. So debut poets often come out with a shorter collection before a full length. And Bird Body is sort of a recovery narrative, thinking through ways of becoming in the world as a young girl and then as a woman, kind of greeting the joys of that world and also navigating kind of the violences through medical experiences and through sexual assault, and also thinking through those moments through a kind of surrealist frame. Mm-hmm. So it's called Bird Body because I'm often in communion with birds in the collection and use those relationships with birds to kind of understand different things that had happened to me.
Sure. So you talking about the relationship with birds in the book, are you using them as metaphor, or are you using it as kind of like literal connections to birds?
Yeah, both. I think it opens in more metaphorical territory and more surrealist territory with the heron, who is one of the main birds in the book, but also literal moments, right? I grew up on a river in North Carolina and was an only child, and so my parents were busy. I often just hung out with birds and hung out at the river, and so learned a lot from literal birds and also, metaphorical.
I love that. Mm-hmm. I can just picture you, like, you know, playing by the river and with your friends, the birds, right? So you had told me that these are some of the earliest poems that you've written, that you put into this chapbook. Mm-hmm. What was it like for you to go back to them for this publication?
It was strange. It was a strange experience. I think it was in some ways really gratifying, right, to really work these poems that had a lot of big ideas that were really important to me but weren't fully that hadn't fully come to fruition on the page yet. And so to kind of rework them to coax out what they were trying to do as an older version of that same poet self was really interesting and gratifying to, like, you know, sweat over these poems and then see them now in a collection. But also it was strange. I mean, to greet this book in the world now, right, in its current form, knowing that the gap between who I am today and who the person is, who the person was writing that book, they're such different people, you know?
Absolutely.
And so navigating that chasm is really interesting. Mm-hmm. So I think I found ways to celebrate and honor the person who wrote those poems, who's still inside me, but I'm kind of a different human now, but to kind of celebrate her and give her space and also, recognize that I'm a different person today.
Absolutely. I think that's such a fascinating process for all artists, I imagine, right? Mm-hmm. To go back to that early work and not only to kind of reinterpret it, right? With all of the information you have now, all the knowledge you have now, all the experience you have now, but then also to have such a personal connection to that original interpretation. Like, I can, I don't know, I just think that's a really profound experience and opportunity to have, and maybe one that's unique to artists in a different way. I'm not sure.
Yeah, and I think also there was a big part of me that, like, when this chapbook got accepted, I was kind of on the verge of being like, okay, we're gonna put this chapbook to rest. Yeah. I had reworked it so many times, it had gone through so many different versions, and I had submitted it to so many places, you know, and come close, but never gotten anyone who was interested in publishing it. And so I was like, okay, I think we've done our due diligence, and we're gonna let Bird Body be Bird Body, you know, in the drawer or wherever.
Yeah.
And I was okay with that, but also once it got accepted shortly after, and I think there was a part of me that was like, oh God, the world's gonna see this book, you know?
Sure, right.
And my first reaction, honestly, to that email was, A, it's not true. This is a joke email that I've just gotten that, like, no. This book was accepted. Yeah. And B, like, oh man, how am I gonna navigate, you know, people reading this work that's been such a private process for so long?
Absolutely.
And I, through the process, have come into a place of celebrating that younger self.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and maybe even that comes from what you're recognizing as that separation between who you are now and who you were then, or who the person was that wrote them then.
Yeah.
So one of the things that is a theme throughout the book, right? You said that the book is about confronting trauma. You talked about health. You talked about sexual violence. I'm just curious, especially as an artist, in your opinion, what does poetry contribute to those types of difficult discussions? As we know that that these are shared experiences, right? That multiple people have, although very individual in every circumstance. But I'm just curious if you can think about that a little bit, of like, what does art and what does poetry bring to this discussion?
Yeah, I think that's such a good question. And to be honest, as a poet, living in the real world, right, and seeing all these things come up, and being an activist and wanting to bring about, you know, tangible change, I've kind of come up against this question a lot of why art and why poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And in my experience, poetry specifically, for sexual assault and any kind of violence, I think the world really wants answers and wants evidence and wants kind of a factual basis for the trespasses or the wrongdoing or what exactly happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think poetry and art too, I mean, art at large, right? But they have kind of like a secret alley, I think, of getting around that, like, really human need for the concrete factual details that can often be re-traumatizing and a violence in and of itself, right, to ask for that. But poetry, for me, has an ability to orbit that space and to orbit those truths and actually get at a more accurate representation of the experience, to represent those feelings and that process and that emotion and what happened without pointing to the evidence, right?
Yeah.
It has a way of speaking around it and speaking through it, and for me at least, of working through those emotions too, right? On the page, but without, relying on this, I don't know, really interesting need for hard fact and evidence.
Yeah, I mean, even what you're describing, I think, relates to the dialogue on what maybe a victim-centered approach would be to having these conversations, right? Where we're intentional about not re-traumatizing people who've had violent experiences in their life or traumatic experiences in their life, but still allowing space to process and to heal and to recover and to grow. That's pretty, I think that's amazing. And I love the phrase, I'm going to steal that phrase, that we have, like, that the arts have a secret alley to like leading and guiding these conversations, which I think is amazing. So, I know that you celebrated with a book launch at Dog-Eared Books earlier this month, which is super exciting. Any other plans or events coming up? I know you said that, you know, at one point you're like, I kind of wanted to let it go. But now that the book is coming out, you know, there's usually events and things that are built around it to make sure that people have access to it.
Yeah. And it's such an honor too to have that process of literally like letting the book fly. You know, sure. I'm so leaning into the metaphor of bird body all the time. But to like setting it out into the world is such a, such an interesting journey. But I coming up shortly, I'm heading up to Minnesota to read as part of an opening for the Natural Heritage Art Center just outside of Minneapolis. And that's going to be really incredible to see, how that work interacts with other folks who are writing around environmental themes and celebrating specifically natural art. Mm-hmm. I'm also going to be visiting a women and gender studies class at ISU to talk through some of these poems and see how they land with undergrads, which I'm really excited about. Several Zoom readings,
of course.
And all of those will be posted on my website. So cool. Yeah.
Would you be willing to share one of the poems from Bird Body with us?
Yeah, I would love to.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah.
So I'm going to read, after emailing your mom, another poem about it. She says she's surprised it still haunts you, brushing the needles from your hair. Says, I'm hard and wish to hell I weren't. You wonder what to write back, how to explain the hostage your nervous system has trained, how the trauma lives quietly for months. Careful not to tip anything over inside you until you find yourself on a date in your own car, a man's arms wrapped around you in fervor, and you have gone slack. Silver grass, limp with first frost, your voice blued in its tunnel. You're sure you were in control, but your body, now bowed into a ball in the driver's seat, didn't get the signal. Everyone wants you to stop writing about it, this unkillable thing. Enough, enough. You have been loved, yes. You are fortunate. Don't harden yourself, baby, your mom writes back. She pulls the splinters from your teeth. Stay open.
Wow. I'm having a hard time responding because that was really powerful and really beautiful. And I mean, I would imagine as a lot of listeners can relate to it, right? Especially, I think personally, one thing that still surprises me about grief and trauma that I hold is when it shows up, right? And that, you know, most of the time you feel like I'm good, right? I've got a beautiful life. I'm fine. But then there are those moments where it's almost difficult to explain. And then, of course, people wanting explanation of why this is happening. So, wow, that was incredibly moving. And I really appreciate you sharing that with us. And just makes me more excited for your book and to hear more and to read more. And even just all the self-reflection that's gonna offer to me, and I'm sure other people that that read it. So, where can people purchase your book if they would like to?
So zoefaceton.com.
We can say it multiple times.
Yeah,
right?
www.zoefaceton.com. And also through my publisher Cordella Press, they have a bookshop tab. But either of those places will link back to them. So yeah.
Perfect. Yeah. So thank you so much for sharing that. So now we'll talk a little bit. So this is some of your earliest work. I know this is a current project with the book release. But you also, in your bio, we mentioned that you're currently an MFA candidate at Iowa State and just in the beginning stages of your thesis project. I know it's early, but can you tell us a little bit more about this project?
Yeah, man, talking about your thesis while being in thesis writing is so wild.
I feel like it's good as a current PhD student, too, who's dissertating. I feel like I keep telling people, like, I'm defending my dissertation in the spring, right? It's not scheduled. It's not written.
And I'm not defending it right now.
Right? I'm not defending it right now. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. No, it's been a really incredible process. So the poetry collection, so it is a poetry collection for my thesis that I'm working on. And this one wrangles with codependency and thinking through codependent lessons and habits and just what that means for a human in the world building relationships. Mm-hmm. And so through that kind of core personal narrative of quote unquote recovering from codependency, it's the collection is also thinking about just caretaking relationships in general and mm-hmm. ways that we, I mean, that's such a broad term, but like mm-hmm. ways that we engage with each other as humans with other beings in the natural world, just as communities in a small scope and across the globe too. So just thinking about these relationships of care mm-hmm. and kind of relearning, right, healthier ways as a recovering codependent person, relearning a healthy attachment to people, relearning what it means to, you know, support and care for a community, having healthy boundaries, having mm-hmm. healthy attachments, and really learning from the environments around me, especially the two landscapes I was raised by, right? This riverscape in North Carolina, in mm-hmm. rural North Carolina, and super small town in the south of France as well. And so taking from both of those landscapes, these lessons of how we care for each other, whether it's the, you know, like I think the best example of this kind of interspecies caretaking would be mm-hmm. the wood wide web, right? These the trees who are in reciprocal relationships with the fungal networks that mm-hmm. that feed them nutrients, right, and that store their sugar, and that the trees kind of sending messages to warn each other, you know, even outside of their own tree species, to warn each other if there's a blight coming or if there's a sickness coming. So that's really like one of the most, I think, one of the examples that a lot of folks have heard about, right?
Yeah.
Of just ways that that beings in different species take care of each other.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think exactly what you're talking about. My first introduction to that was with the really popular novel, The Overstory, mm-hmm. by mm-hmm. Richard Powers, mm-hmm. right? And I think it was such an eye-opening read for me to think differently, not just about other living things mm-hmm. around me, but also this idea, right, you say, of kind of responsible caretaking, like yeah. in different communities, whatever that means.
Yeah.
So there's a lot there, right? In that thesis.
Easy. It's been super easy. I just wrote it really quickly and it'll be done soon. Yeah.
Can you describe a little bit more, just because you used the word a few times, just mm-hmm. like give us a definition. What do you mean by recovering codependent when you're talking about this work?
Yeah, and I think this actually resonated back with what you were saying about the way that trauma and grief lives inside you and, mm-hmm. and kind of surprises you. I think that recovering is a really interesting word because surely you recover from some things, but in my experience, any things I've lived through still live inside me, and recovering from codependency, I don't think I'm ever going to be healed from that or completely outside of the codependent mindset of how we're supposed to engage with people. So to back up a little bit, thinking about codependency is kind of a more toxic way of building relationships. It's an attachment. It's a way of attaching to another person in a way that has really high expectations, that kind of gives too much to the other person, and so that you are kind of emptied and don't have enough in your cup to give from, mm-hmm. right? There aren't a lot of healthy boundaries, and it's kind of setting up both people in that codependent relationship to not do well. And so recovering from that basically just looks like kind of learning how my brain works, how I was taught to be in relationship, and kind of, you know, untangling some of those expectations and, mm-hmm. and constructs about what I think love looks like. Mm-hmm. And mainly just, yeah, boundaries. Establishing yeah. boundaries, you know, saying, actually, I'm, you know, I need a nap. I need to take care of myself. Mm-hmm. I need to rest before I can give to you. And learning that so that I can be in better relationship with the world and so that I can support my community, my people, my beloveds in a really healthy, strong way.
Yeah, I love that. And I love any opportunity to talk about the value of boundaries.
Yep.
Right? Yes. It's such, yes. And I agree, it's something that has to be learned, right? Mm-hmm. You're taught, you know, so many different ways as children and, you know, young adults, ways to not have firm boundaries as mm-hmm. a way as a practice of self-care, but also I think what you're identifying as a really loving practice of yeah. healthy relationships.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it can be hard too to see boundaries as this like no, not you and not now, right? But it's a way of loving people better.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that it's interesting how you connect it beyond people too, right? Mm-hmm. That it's also your relationship with the environment mm-hmm. and your relationship with other living mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. Which I see as a component of kind of climate justice, right? Mm-hmm. In the way that you think, in the way you approach mm-hmm. your art. I'm really curious, because of some of your other identities and other things we've talked about, do you see an intersection between how you approach that, like your relationship mm-hmm. with the living world, the natural mm-hmm. world, and gender or queerness?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And it's such a joy to wrangle with these thoughts and to like think through them, and I'm still kind of in the early phases of being able to articulate that. So yeah. Thank you for asking that question. And also yeah. like, I think I'll keep it short because there's so much that is true about how all of those things interact, right? They're all deeply foundationally connected. I think the thing I keep coming back to with clarity right now, and I feel like I've been saying love over and over, and I'm just going to be like the woo-woo love girl this morning.
I'm okay if I say like love and boundaries yeah. a
yeah.
lot. Like
just those say are... it over and over for the rest of the year.
Those are two words that are good to hear.
Yeah. But it does come back to that. It comes back to building radical love, both with myself and my beloved. That a lot of kind of normative society would not like to see in mm-hmm. the world, right? Loving in that same kind of radical way and defending the earth with that love, right? Mm-hmm. And being a steward of my environment. And so that both of those are instances of radical love that's really powerful, right? Mm-hmm. And structural powers, and like I'll be explicit and say I mean capitalism, I mean white supremacy mm-hmm. and settler colonialism, right? Those structures don't make room for queer love mm-hmm. or for environmental love or for any of those radical things, because they're dangerous, right? And they're powerful.
Yeah.
And I think that for me is one really clear way of the ways that they interact, of just freeing up a love that makes it more possible to do right by all kinds of different ways of being in the world and protecting an earth that is in danger right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that. And I love how you bring all of that together through your poetry and also put that out into the world through the mm-hmm. art that you make as a way of spreading that and yeah. just increasing, right? The number of people that are going to recognize the power that's there yeah. in that kind of radical love.
That's the hope.
Yeah, that's the hope, yeah. which is yeah. awesome. So we've talked about your earliest poems with mm-hmm. Bird Body and the most current project, which mm-hmm. is, you know, in production, right, with the MFA thesis. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could share with us just a little bit about what brought you to poetry in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. I was really shepherded into poetry. So my mom is a poet. Shout out to my mom. She's a published poet and has been for my entire life and surrounded me with poets as I was growing up. And so I really had no choice. It was just yeah. like, you will be among the poets. Yeah. And then same thing happened throughout high school and throughout undergrad, of just people kept kind of nudging me towards poetry. My my teachers in high school, who I applied for the fiction editor position at the Lit Mag, and the teacher was like, actually, you should do poetry, you know? And so throughout my life, this kind of kept happening of like an ushering back towards poetry. And I was like, okay, I'll keep giving this a shot. And what ended up happening through that process is I got anchored with poetry, right? Mm-hmm. And I started to be able to understand the world through mm-hmm. writing poetry. And that became such a grounding practice for me that now I really don't understand how to live in the world without just that practice, right? Yeah. Of a way of digesting the world and making it make sense through writing for me.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you're now choosing poetry, mm-hmm. right? After it's been suggested to you mm-hmm. for a lot of your growing up years. Mm-hmm. What as an artist, as a poet, how do you create a structure around making sure it is a consistent habit and it is a consistent practice for you?
Yeah, it's so hard to do, right? It takes a lot of willpower because the world is like, but stay busy and do all these other things and don't practice regularly. I think, honestly, being in this program, the creative writing program at Iowa State, has really nurtured me and helped me set up a really consistent practice so mm-hmm. that I take it seriously. It's not peripheral anymore, you know? I wake up every morning around 6:30 and meditate and read and write, hopefully. It's not happening this semester with Bird Body and with all of that, but that's been a really consistent practice, as much as possible, is just to carve out space in the morning to be with the page and kind of the dark hours where nobody's, pinging me yet.
Yeah, so. And I think that's, I asked that question because I think it's really good for writers to hear, right? That just finding different ways to create like a ritual around mm-hmm. giving yourself that time and that space. Mm-hmm. And especially, I totally understand the mornings, right? You're not getting new emails, you're not mm-hmm. getting messages, you know, there's a little bit more quiet in the morning. Mm-hmm. So if you can be a morning person.
Yeah. I know it's not for everyone.
Not for everybody, the other question I have, also related to just your writing practice, is that writing is often so solitary, mm-hmm. right? And so especially as you're writing about so many things that are about being connected and about mm-hmm. community, how do you stay connected to community through your writing?
Yeah, it's such an important question. It's so solitary. Mm-hmm. It's so, you're the one person writing it often, right? And then if you're hoping to publish, it's, you can't share that work with the world if you're hoping to publish it, because presses or journals won't accept previously like shared or shown work.
Sure.
And so it can be really isolating to write through that and spend so much time with it and take so long for the world to see it and to start interacting with people mm-hmm. reading your work. So it has been really important to build community. I think mainly art exchanges with friends, right? Like accountability groups, sharing poems like Google Doc style with my co-writers, and just getting folks to give early feedback, right? And just also sitting down with them somewhere and writing alongside each other has been really important. I have a poetry pen pal, I'll call them, mm-hmm. in Canada, Jody Chan. And we met in a virtual workshop many years ago and just kind of kept in touch and have since been sending each other poems back and forth, kind of letter poems, fairly often for the last couple of years. And we've written a chapbook collaboratively together. And that's been really fruitful to think about ways that art and writing can be collaborative too. Mm-hmm. I think also, I'm really invested in making more projects like that, of responding to other people's art, of working with them as, you know, painters or collage artists and responding to their work in poetry form and ways that those pieces can be in dialogue with each other. So that's been really important. And local reading series. So that's like a huge way, that's often the main way that poets can share their work in progress right mm-hmm. before it's published and get audience feedback is through live readings. So yeah, I'm always trying to support local readings.
Which is awesome. And the local reading too, I would imagine, as you were talking about the publishing process, I was thinking about the vulnerability that comes with mm-hmm. that. But then also, I think there's another level of vulnerability mm-hmm. with a public reading too.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that when you're in that stage of like getting feedback. But with especially that vulnerability, I'm wondering, how do you maintain just your self-care in those moments? Like, what have you learned through the mm-hmm. process of seeking publication, mm-hmm. of sharing your poems? Like, what are some things that you've learned that might help listeners who are, you know, aspiring writers yeah. to, like, think about how they can take care of themselves throughout the whole process?
Yeah, it is such a vulnerable process. I really, it's been one of the biggest, especially thinking about codependency, right, and mm-hmm. how codependent folks often seek validation from external sources. I mean, I think a lot of us do that,
yeah.
right? That's not limited to codependency. But there's this really human hunger for somebody outside of you to say, yes, you're doing a good job,
yeah.
you know?
And that's hard with a writing practice that has to involve so much rejection.
Yeah,
in life, right?
Rejection
yeah.
has become my best friend. yeah, it's so much rejection. And it's really like... Yeah, it's building a thick skin, but it's also just kind of, for me, been about learning what the rejection means and what the acceptance means and recognizing that both of them, both the rejection and the acceptance, actually have nothing to do with me, right?
Yeah.
They're totally outside of me. I get to say yes or no to my work, right?
Mm-hmm.
That starts with me. And if the world, different journals, different mediums, whatever they might be, say yes to it, then that's a reflection of them and what they appreciate, right?
Yeah.
And so trying, like, I get to celebrate the acceptances for sure, but I try not to hang my self-worth on them, you know?
Yeah.
So a big part of that process recently has been starting a rejection jar.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I started a rejection jar after, I don't know, my billionth rejection and was like, you know what, I need to like set up a treat system or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a rejection jar now where I put $1 in every time I get rejected. And I really love it because it's kind of reversed that relationship. Like when I get a rejection email for my work, I get to get up, leave the computer, leave the inbox, and move my body and go across the room and pay myself for taking a leap of faith, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's an action, so I'm not just sitting there wallowing and, oh, woe is me, you know, this person didn't like my work. But it's also just recognizing that I made a bet on myself, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then I get to go and have my... buy a rejection lipstick or a rejection beer or whatever it might be, you know, and celebrate the fact that I took that leap of faith.
Yeah, I love that practice. I think
yeah.
that's such a wonderful thing to do and to, again, recognize and celebrate the risk that you are taking in just submitting your work to these places.
Yeah.
And then also, you know, I love the idea of, like, seeing you wearing your rejection lipstick,
mm-hmm.
like, out on the drink.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. So so we are about finished with the interview.
Yeah.
And if it's okay with you, I'd love to close the interview with another one of your poems, if you have one to share.
Yeah, I would love to. So I think I'm going to read this poem that was published in Longleaf Review earlier this year. And it speaks to I'm reading it because it speaks to this kind of community caretaking that we've been talking about.
Yeah.
And that same thriving and nurturing relationships across species boundaries.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's also a poem in conversation with Paige Lewis, poet Paige Lewis, and lifts a line from their poem, "I've Been Trying to Feel Bad for Everyone." So this is poem beginning with a line from Paige Lewis. I know it isn't always about suffering. I mean, just yesterday, on a soppy trail of gunked gravel, an orange newt. An orange freaking newt. Rash slap of color in my small morning blues. And you're telling me there's no higher spirit when bright orange lizards run around all specked with spots and looking into your eyes with their eyes on a Tuesday? And then fistfuls, I mean fistfuls, of daisies lining the way out. On the incline, someone set up a rickety chair to watch for God knows what, surrounded by a series of pulleys and levers, so probably that house is one we should mostly avoid, I guess, sure. But anyway, did you know the tulip poplars shading these hills are nicknamed fiddle trees for their leaves shaped like tiny violins? All around, green symphonies floating down to greet us. Everyone today a little extra puffed up, all brazen in their bedazzlement, all fussed with care. And when I walked by the chicken coop, reader, the chickens walked me home. One got loose with her three chicks, and after a week of freedom surrounded by Lord knows what kind of roaming teeth, they're all still clucking along. Isn't that a good sign? The teenagers next door called me beautiful when I passed by. Two young creatures climbing a bloomed crab tree, and I swear I felt a dozen wounds zip shut inside me all at once. I know I've been writing a lot about death because there's been a lot of death recently, but I promise to braid the soft and hard in equal measure, to try being a little funnier in my fireside telling so we can pace each joy hunt, paint our skins in a sheen so dizzying only the sun might recognize us, God burst orange, and go crawling, gleeful, along the path on all fours.
I love that. That was a perfect closing to our interview. So thank you so much, Zoe, for being here and for talking with me today. Let's just remind everyone listening how they can find you online to keep up with the things that you're doing.
www.zoefaystint.com. Yeah, you can Google me and you'll find the website.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening to Articulations, brought to you by the Margaret Sloss Center for Women and Gender Equity and KHOI Community Radio 89.1 FM. Our interview is edited by Rosie Rowe. Join us next week, Monday at 4 p.m., for the final interview in this series, a conversation with Tanvi Rastogi. To round out the hour, we invite you to sit back and enjoy a selection of songs picked by Zoe. You can find the full Articulations playlist on Spotify or on the Sloss Center website.